I would now like to recall the brutal suppression of his strike, during which 34 miners were killed by police gunfire. The events took place exactly 10 years ago at a platinum mine in Marikana, a town in South Africa 80 kilometers west of Pretoria. On August 10, 2012, 3,000 miners joined a wildcat strike demanding a 125% wage increase. A few weeks earlier, the British mining company Lonmin had negotiated higher wages with some miners without union involvement, and the remaining workers wanted to match their wages. The pro-government union NUM, whose former general secretary was Cyril Ramaphosa, who is now president of the Republic of South Africa, and the management at the platinum mine refused to listen to the workers' claims. So the miners rushed to their union office to submit their demands. There, NUM leaders, so leaders of the trade union, opened fire on the strikers, injuring two people. In the hours and days that followed, the situation continued to escalate and four miners were shot. Two policemen and two security guards were burned and killed with machetes. After these events, the workers continued to refuse to return to work and gathered with their families on a nearby hill. Four or five of the strikers carried firearms, hundreds more were unarmed. Meanwhile, the police had arrived with a contingent of 800 men and several tanks and helicopters. They surrounded the hill with barbed wire and opened fire on the crowd. A few minutes later, more strikers were shot dead on a nearby hill, at least 14 of them from behind or with their arms raised. On 16th of August, 34 miners were killed and 78 others injured. The following day, the police action was described by numerous media outlets as the Marikana Massacre. I spoke to Warren McGregor about this massacre of miners and its impact on society and trade union politics. Warren McGregor works as a program coordinator for the Global Labour University at University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, South Africa. He is an anarcho-syndicalist activist with trade unions and also social movements in Africa. Warren, I'm very happy to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
So we heard the introduction about the events around the 16th of August 2012, now a decade ago. And my first question would be, you are involved in trade union education and workers' organizing. And in this violent conflict, two competing unions played a role. So the National Union of Mine Workers, NUM, and the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, AMCU. Can you tell us about these unions and why the hell the NUM leaders opened fire on its own members?
That speaks to the history of the development of trade unionism to an extent in post-democratic South Africa, or by that I mean since 1994, when there was the defeat of political apartheid and where the formerly oppressed black population, by that I mean black African, mixed race or colored, and Indian workers, achieved political freedom, at least. The National Union of Mine Workers, which was formed in 1983, interestingly, its first general secretary was Cyril Ramaphosa, who is the current president of South Africa, and who at the time of the Marikana massacre was an executive member of the Lonmin company that owned the mine. They had, since the early 90s, as an affiliate of the COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, had been and still is in a formal alliance with the South African Communist Party, with the ruling party, the African National Congress. For those of you who might not know, was the party of Nelson Mandela, which came to power in 1994 and which continues to be in power until this day. What had essentially happened over a long period of time and for a variety of reasons, which we can go into a bit later, a distance had been created between the NUM leadership and the workers that they were representing and were members of the union itself. In particular, this leadership came to be represented by the full-time shop stewards, which had been won in struggle by workers, had become over time very distant from the membership claiming that and asserting that the shop stewards were no longer representing their best interests and essentially were acting as a buffer between management and the majority of the workers who were in the union. So much so that a few days before the massacre, there had been a buildup of tension for a number of years between the rank and file workers and their leadership. So much so that in an ongoing dispute with management for higher wages and better working conditions, the workers felt that the shop stewards were not representing their best interests and had led a march to the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers Shop Stewards office, and an office that essentially represented the union leadership at the mine. These workers were then fired on, as your introduction stated. Many of the problems inherent to the condition of the National Union of Mine Workers at the time, which also in some way represents some of the key problems with trade unionism in South Africa, or at least in the more longer standing and bigger trade unions in South Africa, had essentially come to the fore. And this included the creation over time of a very bureaucratic layer within the trade union, a layer which essentially had been built through the years of struggle and after 1994, but which essentially spent lots of time engaging with management on behalf of workers. But over time, these full-time shop stewards that were given in certain circumstances, particular positions in management, or if not positions in management, spend most of their time engaging with management. This led to quite a lot of distance between the NUM shop stewards and the workers themselves. I'm not sure if I answered your question correctly. Could you just repeat it?
Yes, I think so. So I was just asking, like, how this could be, because this was really shocking me when I read about the events that the workers first walked to their trade union office, and their open fire was opened and people were severely injured. So I think you answered the question. What I also like heard in your words, that you were stressing that the political apartheid ended. So some kind of apartheid goes on. And is this also connected to what one could call kind of a corruption, because the former general secretary of the NUM was then member of the board of the Lonmin, the owners of this mine. So what were you meaning by stressing that political apartheid ended?
As we all know, with the development of any colonial and post-colonial circumstance, particularly on the African continent, the historic conditions continue to plague most, if not all, post-colonial African societies, including South Africa. Now, South Africa's era of colonialism is essentially divided into two parts. You had original European direct colonialism, particularly under the Dutch, and then more formally under the British, particularly with the discovery of diamonds and gold in certain parts of Southern Africa from the 1860s onwards. And with that, you had the creation of essentially a super exploitative capitalist system here in South Africa, which was essentially based on the minerals and energy complex which we have here, which still continues to dominate the South African economic and also to a large extent policy framework. But a minerals and energy complex, particularly around mining, diamonds and gold, and then later platinum mining, which was based on the super exploitation of black people. So the second period of colonialism is usually referred to as, you know, a special kind of colonialism in South Africa, where despite the fact that South Africa, around about the same time that you had the same situation in Ireland, in Australia and Canada, the granting by the British of home rule, but home rule in South Africa was essentially based on, was actually based on minority white rule. And this minority white rule, which also created a political system, you know, based on the segregation of, in particular, the working class, into different races, which were allowed to do similar, which were allowed to do particular kinds of work. This era of segregation essentially is formalized in what then becomes apartheid, the formal political and economic systems of apartheid, which essentially comes into being from 1948. So although racial inequality and a racist political and economic system exists before the advent of apartheid in 1948 due to colonialism, it's essentially really formalized and entrenched in South African society from 1948 onwards. But this system, economically at least, is still there as the colonial era was. The initial colonial era was based on the super exploitation of black labor. The super exploitation was not only based on the remuneration and the working standards experienced by black workers, but also ensured by the political framework of the country. So this is very important because oppression is not only in the economic realm, but it's also in the political and social realm. Although political freedom was won from, you know, in the early 90s and mid 90s, in that for the first time in South African history, you had the right to vote being available to all people in South Africa, to all citizens, to all South African citizens. And that technically your opportunities for life could no longer be officially and politically determined and relegated by your race. Obviously, the political and economic history of the country, which denied for the vast majority access to power and access to the free development of life, of their own lives, continued to play a role in the new South Africa, and continues to play a role in the new South Africa period. Importantly, because number one, the system of capitalism has been perpetuated, also in its particular form, neoliberal capitalism, which limits the role for the state in being able to redistribute surplus and redistribute profits, which have been accrued from capitalist industry to broader society. But also the fundamental nature of this African economy hasn't really changed. The minerals and energy complex with mining at its center continues to be a key, if not the key, and central feature of South African capitalism, along with the developing financial sector. But this capitalist system is still continues to be based on the super exploitation of black people and super exploitation of black workers in particular. Not only was the struggle at Marikana, the workers recognizing the tremendous profitability of platinum mining in South Africa, but so too their struggles, which went alongside the struggles of those in their community. Although obviously the wage that they were demanding and the wage demanded by the rock drill operators as a section of the mine workers was the key feature. The broader community that these workers came from, that they were living in the impoverished communities surrounding the platinum mines, were also key to not only supporting the mine workers, but have been key in the post-Marikana situation as well, as regards the focus of activists and regards the focus of worker complaints and worker activism since then. So despite the fact that political apartheid was defeated to an extent, in that the policies of the government and the state of South Africa, which denied rights to black people, these were removed. A new constitution was created, which on paper, you know, is a relatively progressive and liberal constitution without the concomitant economic freedom, which has been denied the majority of people in South Africa. These political freedoms can only really exist on paper and can only really be used by those, by a small group within all races in South Africa who have access to the channels of power, both economically and politically.
Mm. I also read that maybe this is also one example of ongoing colonialism in an economic and apartheid in an economic sense, that I think it was ANC who also allowed the headquarters of firms to move outside the country to Europe and the US, so to London, New York and Switzerland. And also the German super big company BASF is very closely connected to the Lonmin, and makes, I think, 10% of its profits from buying the platinum and also reselling it again partly. So indeed. Yeah, you can really see that this relation is still very connected to the history of colonialism and apartheid.
You know, indeed, and much like the rest of post-colonial Africa, despite South Africa's semi-industrialized nature, which has provided it with a relatively more wealthy economy than many other African economies, the South African economy has over time become pretty much like any other African economy, in that it is fundamentally what it exports are primary commodities. So, you know, some decades ago, there was a new term created, the term of neocolonialism, in that ultimately during colonialism, the African territories, the African colonies were turned, their economies destroyed, their cultures destroyed, so as to turn those areas and those territories and those colonies into, number one, primary commodity exporters, and to turn their population into producers of those primary commodities. Much like the rest of Africa, South Africa's economy, number one, has become extraordinarily neoliberalized, and much more than it should have, and much more than it was actually demanded of, it became very early on in the mid-90s, a very keen participant under the ANC government and in its relationship with big South African monopoly capitalism. It became a very keen participant in this continually globalized economy. In so doing, it became convinced that the way forward for the South African economy and thus for social economic development was to participate as a commodity exporter. But the commodities that were being exported from South Africa and which continue to be exported from South Africa continue to be primary commodities, particularly linked to the mining sector. Importantly also, as a keen participant in this globalizing process, the South African government under the ANC put in very stringent measures from the 90s onwards to liberalize the economy. This includes, very importantly, the relaxing of financial controls, which meant that local South African monopoly business, still essentially controlled by white people at the time or a white elite at the time, as well as any foreign interests in South Africa, the financial controls on investments, particularly on international investments, were relaxed, which meant, and which continues to mean, that despite the fact that South Africa is not a poor country, it is a relatively wealthy economy. Much of the wealth which is created by the work of the majority black working class, or by the working class which is majority black, the vast amounts of these profits are not reinvested locally and are essentially invested on hot markets, on the big stock exchanges around the world, which has meant that over time, as in other places in the world, you have this increasing gap between an extraordinarily wealthy elite, which resides both in the private as well as in the state economy, because you must remember that the state in South Africa is the biggest player in the local economy, controlling directly or indirectly about a third of the South African economy. These elites, both in the state and in the private sector, have become extraordinarily more wealthy, to the detriment of development projects and more broader socioeconomic development, which has meant that the majority of the South African population continue to live in extraordinary poverty and are denied ultimately the very fruits of their labor, which is what the Marikana workers were campaigning for, just to get a little bit more of the surplus and the wealth that their labor was creating.
Yeah, I think this also partly explains why the reaction was so brutal and so violent, because the workers really challenged the state of the things and demanded, I think, 125% more wages and also some kind of social security. So after this Marikana massacre, like already next day, the media called it a massacre and there was a lot of coverage, I think. And there was a inquiry or a commission established. It's called the Falem Inquiry, to try to look through the events, what happened where. It was, but it was also criticized a lot. I would like to ask you about this Falem Inquiry and also something I read, which also connects to the things you said, that politically, but also economically, apartheid continues some kind of, because I think there was a doctrine or an act was used, because the workers taking part in the strike were accused of murder, although they were mostly unarmed, because of a doctrine of common purpose previously used by the apartheid government. So maybe you can tell us something about this Falem Inquiry and commission, and also the legal issues which came up in this commission, and also, yeah, something about this I would like to hear.
So just one more aspect on the background, which we touched on, was the brutality of the response. Just before the financial crisis, the global financial crisis of about 2007-2008, platinum and platinum mining in South Africa had been on a very steep upward trajectory, and the rates of profitability were extraordinarily high. It was then forecast at the time that platinum would become the most important mining or mined commodity, overtaking gold and diamonds in South Africa. And so this was quite an historic, at least from a historical point of view, this was quite an historic turn, because of the nature of diamond mining and gold mining to the development of South Africa, both its politics and its economy. But the impact of the global financial crisis meant that, despite the fact that tremendous amounts of profits were being made, the rate of profitability was starting to decrease. But the workers were aware of the amount of wealth, and had always been aware of the amount of wealth and the importance of their sector to the South African economy. And thus, mine workers have always had a sense of their historical place within this development of South African society, not just South Africa, but Southern African society. But the very brutal response and the nature of the response to workers before and after Marikana reflected not just the importance of mining, the continued importance of mining and platinum mining to the South African economy and to its elites in the state and private sector, but also as an attempt to try and quell the protests and to stop the protests and the strike as quickly as possible. Essentially, it got out of, to an extent, it got out of control, in that the Lonmin executive and the state, they could not control the workers as they initially had planned. And thus, aware of the workers' militancy, aware of their discipline, and aware of their ability to and desire to stick it out until the demands were met, the state felt and the Laman executive felt that the strike had to be broken up by any extent. At the time, and this is then important for the Falun Commission later, because what the Falun Commission and other independent research uncovers is the collusion between the Lonmin executive and the South African state. Particularly key players were the Lonmin executive at the time, including Cyril Ramaphosa, who at that time was not a leading member of the ANC, or at least not a key decision maker within the ANC, and was outside of the political realm or outside of politics in South Africa to a large extent. But because of his historic ties to the Union, but also his historic ties to the ANC, the ruling party, he becomes a key interlocutor on behalf of Lonmin between the executive and the state. He then engages with, and other players engage with, the Minister of Police, as well as the Provincial Commissioner of Police. So South Africa, like Germany, is divided into what we call provinces. And although we don't have a federal system, there is a certain amount of power that resides at the provincial level. Now, I must be clear that the Minister of Police, Cyril Ramaphosa himself, and the Commissioners of Police, as well as the heads of the police that were involved in this collusion, and ultimately in what I would call a conspiracy against these workers, the majority of them were African, the majority of them were Black. And these are the ones who gave the final orders, ultimately. The use of live ammunition was not a spur-of-the-moment decision on the last day when the workers were killed. Live ammunition had been, first of all, the police were corralled around and had been mobilized around the areas where the workers were protesting days before. The delivery of live ammunition to the police occurred days before the actual massacre took place, which meant that, and which must mean, that the decision to use live ammunition was always on the cards, in particular for the state. Now, it can be successfully argued, I guess, that Cyril Ramaphosa was not the final decision maker on the use of live ammunition, but he was involved in those conversations and must take central blame alongside key government officials at the time, the Minister of Police, as well as that's in the actual state structure, in the political structure, and then the Commissioner of Police, the Provincial Commissioner of Police at the time. The Commissioner, just as a side, was questioned at the Falun Commission. The results of the Falun Commission have been thus: nobody in the state and the executive has been found guilty of anything. There have been no arrests that have been made of any police officials and government and state officials, nor Lonmin executives. And as you correctly said, the people who were actually held to justice, and I'm using this in inverted commas, were the actual protesting mine workers who, as you say, were charged for murder using the common purpose law, which is essentially ludicrous. Particularly ludicrous because those who were actually responsible for killing those workers, for executing those workers, and prior to that, for giving the order to use live ammunition, and for the conspiratorial arrangements between the exec and the state, none of these individuals and none of these structures have been held to account at all. The Falun Commission ultimately, despite exposing or was able to expose a lot of this apparent collusion and a lot of the details around the massacre itself, both before and after, essentially, like previous South African commissions, has not been able to hold those ultimately responsible to account. And this is a sad indictment, not only of the commission itself, but of the South African political process.
I read also that some email communication between Cyril Ramaphosa and the police officer were leaked or were given to the Falun inquiry. And you could really see how Ramaphosa already like frames the workers as criminals, and really like this class hatred which comes from his words. And and he's now president of the Republic of South Africa since some years. I forgot now when he started to do this, and he's now like a millionaire and an influential business man.
Indeed, and this is one of the sad stories about the South African democratic transition. I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa was the first general secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers, which was formed in 1983. Prior to that, he was a law student, but he used that to essentially organize workers on the mines, particularly in the north of South Africa. And that initiative was used to launch the National Union of Mine Workers in 1983. He was the general secretary for some years and was also key in the trade union unification talks of the late 80s, which formalizes itself into the creation of the Congress of South African Trade Unions in 1987. So particularly in the 80s, he had been a key figure and a key leader, not only in the struggle to organize workers, but also in the struggle against apartheid, using trade union organizations, which were at the forefront alongside community organizations of the struggle against apartheid. It was essentially the workers and the community movements of Black South Africans that brought apartheid to its knees. He then leads the trade union movement and becomes part of the ANC delegation that is negotiating the democratic transition with the apartheid state and capital at the time. But as soon as a new government is formed in 1994, he leaves and goes into the private sector, takes advantage of the new policies and laws around affirmative action, and then later on the Black economic empowerment created by the ANC government, and uses that essentially to become a billionaire in South Africa. He was very famous as stating in the late 80s and the very early 90s that the future of South Africa, the future of the South African economy, must include the workers, to then a couple of decades later claiming that the workers, many of whom were organized in the trade union he helped to create, were now criminals for conducting very much the same actions as he would have encouraged workers and had organized workers to do back in the 1980s. Mm. So it's quite a sad state.
Indeed.
Now, another important thing about the Farlam Commission is that what the Farlam Commission also uncovers is that those in the state responsible for this are not just the Minister of Police, because what we have in South Africa, we have particular clusters of ministers and government officials. So there's a security cluster, which includes the police, which includes the Minister of Police and other key government officials. And this cluster essentially is responsible for creating and implementing security policy in South Africa, including police policy. So therefore, although the Minister of Police was the most visible participant in this collusion against the workers, there's a security cluster that must also take responsibility, which includes not just high-ranking members of that security cluster, but the president of South Africa at the time, Jacob Zuma.
And what kind of consequences had this? I mean, obviously the workers lost the last trust in the NUM union, I guess, after this atrocity in Marikana. So what happened to the union landscape in South Africa? Maybe you can tell us also something about trade unions now. I only read that the membership in this big traditional trade unions like NUM and like declined, and also the COSATU, which is the Federation of Trade Unions, of official trade unions in South Africa. Maybe it's the same like we have here in Germany with the DGB. So the membership declined, and smaller unions. I read about the AMCU, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, gained members. Maybe you can tell us something about the changes in the trade union landscape due to the massacre of Marikana.
As you correctly called them earlier, AMCU, we call them AMCU here in South Africa. They were the big beneficiaries of the immediate post-Marikana situation. The union still continues to exist, but much like trade unionism in other sectors of the South African economy, there's lots of membership that shifts to and fro. But importantly, number one, AMCU was formed in 1999, and the leader of AMCU, who continues to be the leader of AMCU today, was a NUM shop steward at the time. He then leaves NUM for a variety of reasons and forms AMCU. But AMCU really have a very, very small footprint, located in particular mines in the northwest and Limpopo provinces of South Africa. Because of the visibility of the AMCU leader at the time of Marikana, where he had a bit more, but limited limited trust of the workers, his union was able to use the situation to gain substantial membership. But over time, some of the same problems that had occurred in NUM, including authoritarian leadership and the use of union position for self, for personalized wealth accumulation, some of the same problems start occurring within certain aspects of AMCU's operations, or at least the operations of, or the workings of certain officials at certain mines, which means that despite the fact that many workers left to join AMCU, many workers have also gone back to the National Union of Mine Workers as its leadership changed over time, and as the Union of Mine Workers, its legacy within the mining industry and its relative power to be able to bargain was seen as a better option for workers over time. Although the numbers of the membership numbers have dropped quite substantially, NUM continues to be the key player, the key trade union player within the mining, within the mining sector in South Africa. But NUM also plays a key political role. So remember at the start of the interview, I spoke about the formal alliance between COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the South African Communist Party, and the ANC, the African National Congress, the ruling party. This alliance persists to today. One of the key features of the trade union movement after the Marikana massacre was that many people at the time, particularly on the left and those associated with the trade union movement, predicted that Marikana would be the final break with the ruling party, where the predicted movement of the working class, which had been predicted before the establishment of a democratic South Africa, that what would happen would be that the workers would move away from the alliance and form their own independent political movement, whether that be political organizations, political parties. But essentially, it was predicted that the workers would move away from that. They were then able to use the Marikana massacre as the signpost that this would be the fundamental break. Now, what you've had is essentially a variety of different kinds of splits from COSATU and from the affiliates, the individual trade union affiliates of COSATU. Number one, Marikana also highlighted the fact that there were key leaders of COSATU who were in now visible and open disagreement with the president of South Africa and the policies of the ANC. Also, there was a key union, NUMSA, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, who continues to be a powerful trade union in South Africa. They also had become, through their general secretary, Irvin Jim, had become very vocal and critical of South Africa's neoliberal trajectory and thus the foundational economic policies of the ruling party, the ANC. In so doing, Nomsa was expelled from Kusatu, and using a variety of other allegations, the general secretary of Kusatu, Zwelinzima Mavavi, was also expelled from Kusatu, or at least he was fired or recalled from his position, his elected position as general secretary. What these two different constituencies of power, Zwelinzima Mavavi, who still has the trust of many, many black workers in South Africa, and then Nomsa, these two centers of power, having been expelled from Kusatu, go out and form SAFTU, the South African Federation of Trade Unions. But ultimately, this federation is the result of the need for a trade union home for both Nomsa and Zwelinzima Mavavi. So thus, it can be argued that the formation of this federation is a top-down formation, not from the bottom up. And importantly, the majority of the affiliates of SAFTU are very localized, regional, city-based trade unions. Many of them are also splits from their mother Kosatu union. Although this formation and the post-Marikana setting and how this imprinted itself on the minds of workers was viewed as the fundamental break, politically at least, between workers, between black workers and the ANC, this hasn't really resolved itself into that right now. First of all, it's important to understand that what we've discovered in South Africa, much like older liberal democracies, again in inverted commas, is that when it comes to voting patterns, people don't change easily. And particularly because of the historical links that were made between the workers' movement and the ANC through individuals or attachment to individuals, but also attachment to an idea of what the ANC represents for people, particularly for older workers, it has been very difficult to break that. Also, ideologically, because of the influence of the South African Communist Party and also the ineffectiveness of the South African Communist Party in the South African political landscape, the ideologies that many workers and the organizations are influenced by are state-based ideologies. The view is that for real fundamental change to be made, you need to get into the state to be able to do so. Now, of course, you and I would disagree with that. And in fact, South African history actually shows that, is that when workers were the most militant and most influential, they were actually outside of the state machinery. But anyway, for those who decide to vote in South Africa, for the workers who decide to vote, many of them still vote for the ANC.
So this is maybe a tough question, but of course this is a good example for a direct action, for an action outside the state and outside the traditional trade unions who lost the contact to their members. But given the big loss and the violence, would you say this strike shouldn't have happened, or what is your personal view on that?
To be honest, I'm not sure if the murders of workers and the number of murders of workers is ever inevitable, because I think killing somebody is a choice that one makes, and as one can decide not to do it even if you are given an order to do so. But if you look at the nature of the development of the South African police force, that's called the police service now, but its reactions to, for a variety of reasons, bad training, you know, but also bad leadership in particular. The South African police force responds to crowd control and to crowds in a very violent way. Its immediate stance is to jump to violence, to disperse, and this could be includes the use of stun grenades, tear gas, rubber bullets, and then, as you saw in Marikana, live ammunition as well. This has not changed. However, the development of this attitude and the increased militarization of the police in South Africa is kind of embedded in South African society, and we've convinced ourselves that we live in a very violent society. Now, this may or may not be true, depending, but there obviously are different levels of violence that one experiences. But the vast majority of the working class not only live in very impoverished conditions and in squalor, there are distressing rates of violence against youth and violence against women. And when you have a police force whose members come out of a society that they are told is very violent, and when you have a leadership of a police force that takes on the attitude of, you know, action now, ask questions later, then you have, you know, what has been created is a police force that is understaffed, underpaid, susceptible to corruption, from small bits of corruption on the side of the street to high levels of corruption at the top of the system. And then also the use of violence as a first resort. Now, does this mean that the violent response to the Marikana workers was inevitable? I don't know. I don't think I'm, you know, qualified enough to be able to, or knowledgeable enough to be able to say that. But a relatively violent response by the state, I think, was inevitable. If we look at the way that protests and protest crowds had been attempted to be controlled by the police and the state before, there exists in South Africa a culture of political assassination inside and outside of the ruling party, inside and outside of our trade unions, particularly in areas where certain key individuals are very successful at mobilizing people. The response by the state, for example, in the killing of Andries Tatane around the time of the Marikana massacre, Andries Tatane being a social community organizer, a community organization activist and social movement organizer, as well as, and Andries Tatane was just the top of the mountain in that it was quite visible and it was reported extensively throughout South Africa. And this, unfortunately, has become part of the culture of political activism in South Africa.
Mm. Do you know something about the relatives and the widows of the people killed? After the Marikana massacre happened, they were promised reparations and accommodation and even cynically jobs. So the women of the widows of the killed workers were offered jobs in the company which killed their husbands to make a living. So, and I think 5 years ago I had some news about the situation 5 years ago, and it was the fact that not all of them, or just parts of the people who lost their husbands and fathers and got reparations.
Yeah. So there was compensation for loss of income, which was awarded to the families of the slain workers. However, compensation has been given to the majority, but not all of the affected families. Since then, there's been no compensation for constitutional damages. So the breaking of constitutional law, there's been no formal apology. No members of the police service have been disciplined for misconduct, for the actions at Marikana, for killing those workers. No managers within the police service have been disciplined for the lack of oversight. The South African police force has not, and the government has not, prohibited the use of the kinds of rifles and automatic weapons that were used in Marikana for crowd control in South Africa. And importantly, at the same time, just a few other figures. So Lonmin was purchased by another company called Sibanye Stillwater. And during COVID, the profits of the company were around 33.8 billion South African rand, which equates to plus minus, I think, what, 2 billion US dollars. The CEO of the company that now owns the Marikana mines, that person's salary in 2021 during COVID was 14.4 million rand. That's just less than 1 million US dollars. Now, that doesn't seem too much, perhaps in Germany or even the United States, but that's an extraordinary basic salary, not to mention that he obviously, or that the CEO obviously has shares, and dividends are paid out through those shares as well. The rock drillers, because of their struggle in 2012, were able to achieve their wage demand of 12,500 rand a month. 10 years later, taking into account inflation, their wage is 13,000 rand. So over a 10-year period, the wage has only increased by 500 rand a month. So not only has there been limited compensation paid to the families of the victims, but the workers continue to work for wages that perpetuate poverty, and they continue to be super exploited. The company continues to make, or the owner now continues to make, extraordinary amounts of profit at the cost of workers. But this is not just at the workplace. It is also important to think about the ecological impact and the nature of mining communities that have existed around. So you have a couple of communities, particularly around Marikana. Now, these communities, the shelter in which they live and the housing conditions in which they live are extraordinarily bad. But number one, what you have are government-subsidized houses, which are, you know, tiny and badly serviced, and then also informal settlements around that. There's the obvious ecological impact, the pollution of water, which has meant that all sorts of waterborne diseases and other ailments continue to affect the many, many, many who live in the surrounding areas. Also, despite the fact that there's a mining hospital, which is there to service the workers, only services workers. And even if you are a family member, you are not allowed to use that hospital, or at least the hospital cannot serve you, despite the fact that you have been affected by the very operations of the mine itself. Secondly, there's then the air pollution, of course, particularly dust and other kinds of chemicals released into the atmosphere. And then because of bad servicing to these communities, in fact, no servicing, you have continual blocked and overflowing sewage, very poor water quality that is supplied, and where it is supplied, sometimes water is not supplied to homes and not supplied to areas for a variety of reasons, particularly due to state incompetence. And then also some of the more unfortunate social ills of living in impoverished communities. So particularly for women, the exchange of their bodies for work and other forms of income, alcoholism and violence within these communities as well. So it's not just the lack of compensation or limited compensation. There are a host of other factors that workers and their communities continue to be impacted by.
This big German company, like chemical company BASF, as I told, makes a lot of profit with the platinum from the Lonmin mine, and it continues to make big profits. I think 5 years ago it gave 10 cents per share more to its stakeholders or shareholders. Now I don't know the difference. But it rejects every responsibility for what happens in the mines in South Africa. Do you think they also have a responsibility? Can we even, from a big multinational company like BASF, can we even trust them when they say something about social responsibility or economic responsibility? Can we even give them responsibility?
Can we trust them? Of course not. but do we attach responsibility to them? Well, absolutely. If a share of their profits are based on the super exploitation of workers in our platinum mines, well, then absolutely they have a responsibility. Number one, ultimately, these people who suck the lifeblood out of our economies and, you know, out of our workers in our communities, they must be forced to do so. They're not going to do so out of their own goodwill. In fact, they have very little goodwill. They are so far removed from the situation that they can also deny any responsibility, claiming that the responsibility should be left to the local state and to the local company that is controlling mining operations. But of course, they should be held responsible. But it's not just about the price of platinum. It's about what happens to the money accrued from platinum. And here's where I think, number one, international solidarity then becomes important. Despite the ineffectiveness generally of the global union federations, the GAFs, this is no indictment on the individuals therein, who I think I work with some of them, and you know, they're very, very good people doing great work. But they're faced with a monster. And thus, this monster, this globalized capitalist monster and its concomitant financial system needs to be combated by an equally sizable monster. And this can only be workers across the world uniting. But what this means in reality, this really needs to be spoken about a lot more than just going to, you know, ILO meetings and patting ourselves on the back when ILO conventions are signed to by countries. It's a matter of being able to force states and companies into paying a greater share of the profits for local community development. So this includes not just better real wages for workers, but includes better health and safety at work, obviously. But this includes better hospitals, if we're talking about mining, for example, better hospitals and other kinds of social services, which should then be available to all members of that community, the worker and his family and her family as well. This should include better subsidized housing. This should include better subsidized provision of electricity, clean running water, and should also take into account the payment for any damages to local ecology, air, water, and soil. So, of course, can we trust them? No. Should they be held responsible? Absolutely. Mm. Because they are making money off the super exploitation of black workers here in South Africa. But the super exploitation is not just at the point of production. It's also the fact that there's no social wage for these workers at all. They live in squalor and impoverishment, and they are denied access to real control over their lives, the economies, and their politics.
Mm.
So they should be held responsible for that. But how are they going to do that? And this requires us joining hands across regions, across borders, across continents, across oceans, and really start to talk about what international solidarity can actually look like and what it should look like, and for what purpose. Not just only in terms of defensive actions, but also how can we link hands, link solidarity campaigns, link constructive work that sees results on the ground for people. How can we develop that into an alternative project, and a project of counterpower to counter the might and the wealth of the state and private capital, and developing a counterpower for workers and by workers for themselves.